You are listening to This Book I Read, a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm. Welcome to This Book I Read, a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm, where we talk to authors about a book that has stuck with them through the years, for good reasons and sometimes for bad ones. My name is Chris, he, him, also known as CM Lowry Author. I like to read and write pretty much anything. I'd quite like to write a cookbook, but I haven't done yet. Last year, two years ago, released a book of flash fiction called The Die Decides. Find out more about me as allaboutchris.org or on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram as at CM Lowry Author. We are not here to talk about me. This is the moment that we welcome Zilla to the show. Hello, Zilla.
Hello.
Zilla is the author of a cookbook, and also, in fact, both the things that I know you for and have read of yours are a bit sort of weird kind of parafiction. Tell us about them.
Yes. So the cookbook I co-wrote with Rachel Rosen, The Sad Bastard Cookbook, Food You Can Make So You Don't Die, which is sort of a crowdsourced set of recipes that you can make if you're depressed, chronic pain, any kind of low spoons life. It includes recipes like standing in front of the fridge, eating a pickle, and
I think there's bread just straight from the bag. I think that was one.
Yeah. No, it's very much a realistic cookbook. And then Query, which is halfway between fixfic. I don't know if you're from the fanfic community, but when you read a story and it makes you really sad and you're like, I wish I'd written this so I could have written the right ending for one of my good friends Rachel's books, and also about my experiences attempting to be traditionally published, which have ended only in hilarious levels of misery.
That sounds far too close to home. I'm going to the British Sci-Fi Association's convention this weekend, and I'm thinking, how do I get my novel that's in a drawer that's done nothing? What should I make a query package or something with this, and then just not doing anything at all? So that's exciting. Anyway, so why have you come on the show?
Well, there's this book I read.
There's a book you've read. Tell us about it.
So this is Cascade, also by Rachel A. Rosen. And
who's been on the show, in fact?
She has indeed been on the show and talked about Brown Girl in the Ring or something.
I think it was Brown Girl in the Ring. Yeah, it was, yeah. And it was looking at like indigenous culture perspectives on stuff as well. It was good.
Yes. And so Rachel A. Rosen wrote this book about a nice, polite Canadian apocalypse. So climate apocalypse, got a bunch of characters who are trying to work within the system to make things better. It goes about as well as it usually does when people work within the system to try and make things better. And spoilers, about two-thirds of the way through the book, the apocalypse they've been trying to avert, climate catastrophe, kind of comes, and then there's going to be a third of a book and then two more books to come where they try and deal with the situation with magic, because everything is better with magic, including Canadian politics.
Yeah, I agree that many things would sound better if we could magically improve them. I think introducing magic does also really highlight how hopeless the situation of actually getting politicians to achieve anything is.
I think in this book, we have the situation where introducing magic just means magical levels of bureaucracy. So, you have to make sure Parliament approves every spell, and Parliament is about as functional, I think, as your UK Parliament is.
I feel very attacked there. I think Brexit is a great idea. I'm not annoyed by the fact that my foolish fellow countrymen decided to bring in Brexit just before I started a publishing company that involved exporting to Europe. That's been fine. That's not annoyed me at all.
It's all right. At least you haven't had people march on your capital like we did in Canada or Brazil or America.
And we've had protests, not on the we've had big protests in the capital,
But
yes.
have the fascists literally marched on the capital?
I mean, I think the problem is Brexit's been so confusing that everyone is just sort of a bit unhappy with it. Like, as in, no one's got what they want in any way. But also, so the fascists sort of got what they wanted ish with Brexit, but then it's been disappointing. So getting what you want, but it being disappointing, isn't really march on the capital level. So no. So we're slightly winning that one, but also most of the problems that the rest of the world is facing are historically still sort of our fault. So we get to claim all of everybody else's losses as well. So that's nice.
So you're winning in the sense that the fascists are in charge, but they're just not as good at it as they hoped they'd be.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely we had there was I mean we've gone way off track and haven't talked about the book at all, but there was a point a couple of years ago where we were choosing between Boris Johnson, who you've probably heard of, and Jeremy Hunt, who you probably haven't heard of. But basically, the difference between them is Boris Johnson is a fluffy, annoying, evil idiot, whereas Jeremy Hunt is a really efficient evil, like, bad person. And so I'd much rather have the comedy evil that will probably not succeed than the, like, no, we're just going to really efficiently make sure we dismantle the NHS now. Like, that's way worse.
So we may seem off topic, but imagine that plus magic, and that gets you kind of the vibe of Cascade. Maybe a bit more dark humor, but I feel like we're kind of on brand for the dark humor too here.
Yeah, it's the dark humor that's mostly crying with a little bit of laughing because you don't know what else to do. Do you have a quote from Cascade
I
to bring to
do
this?
have a quote. This quote is more vibesy and less of the hilarious dark humor, which was, the one that quote that's in my phone that didn't make me laugh from this book. But it's a good quote anyway. The world is ending. It wasn't really. The world is never ending. What ends is a subjective, personal reality that one has carefully constructed over a lifetime. The plans and human ties and ideologies and the physical trappings of home and family that always seem immutable, permanent. The earth itself would, in all probability, march on, as it had through the Black Death, through the bloodthirsty colonization of Turtle Island, through both world wars, through the Cascade and each one of its horrors and wonders. The weather at the end of this blip it would continue to be able to support human life remained to be seen, but it wouldn't end. It is only your own personal, fragile world that is always in danger.
I mean, that really resonates as a quote, like, especially because the whole of Beyond Cataclysm is based on a quote from John Wyndham's book that says, what's it say? It must be one of the race's most persistent and comforting hallucinations to trust that it can't happen here, that one's own time and place is beyond cataclysm. So that's a very, it's a very, it mirrors that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting thought there also that there's a number of characters in the book who are Tamil, who are Indigenous, and as a Jewish person, I have this experience that I look around and say, it can happen, right? You come from an identity where you have seen your people genocided, where you have seen your people made refugees. And the world end for your people, and a fragment carry on. And so I think there's that difference between the feeling that it can happen here and that it will happen here.
I think there's also a lot of really interesting narrative in the post of that apocalypse. So you talk about the fragments.
Yes.
So actually my grandma came over from Germany on the Kinder transport. So I'm also Jewish heritage. But actually we now come on 50 years and we maybe look at like Israel now, we look at Hausa, and like it's just so complicated, isn't it? Like as in that trauma being carried on and yeah.
Yeah. And the idea that people who've been subjected to horrible trauma can use their pain to commit trauma rather than to try and heal trauma.
Well, there's the phrase, isn't it? Hurt people hurt people, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it sounds like there's quite a lot of people wheeling around hurting each other in Cascade.
Yes. Although I'd say a lot of the people who work within the system are trying to do the right thing. They're more likely to hurt each other on an interpersonal level than they are to deliberately indulge in fascism. The people who are doing that are the people who are the least hurt, but who are trying to remain on top of the power structure.
Yeah. That it all sounds a bit too familiar. It's a bit, I feel, so I haven't read Cascade and I feel annoyed that I haven't read Cascade because I'd be able to add to this. But the problem is because I haven't read it, I'm now just transporting all of this into just commentary on our world and our life, which I'm sure is partly Rachel's intent.
It absolutely is, to the extent that she references Fukushima. There's quite a lot about people rising to prominence through the early days of YouTube and, you know, subtweeting each other. It is very much our world with sort of that level of magical realism to draw attention to the things that are almost too absurd. And I was there while she was writing it. And it had the usual problem that she was only, you know, 6 months ahead of reality.
What is your favorite thing about the book?
My favorite thing about the book is how human all of the characters are. So between all of these machinations, they also watch their favorite TV shows, and they squabble, and they flirt, and they live very ordinary lives at a time of extraordinary things happening. And they're just very much people that you know and that are your friends.
I think that's really important in fiction. I mean, not for us to fall too far into the real world and into some really bad stuff, but Anne Frank's diary, I think one of the reasons it's really stood the test of time is partly because it's such a unique insight into something that happened, but also that she was a normal person, like as in, and interposed with like, we can't make any noise because the Germans are coming. There was just the normal stuff of a 12, 13-year-old girl, like interposed with it.
No, I think it's important to remember that the reason we care about these things is because we care about people.
And I think actually the reason so much like fascism and stuff like that can happen is because people get othered, don't they? So then the people around them, you know, you can get, I think there's a film at the moment out about the family that live next to a concentration camp. And actually like how internally they love one another, you know, even while they're so adjacent and, you know, I think their dad runs the concentration camp. So, So
it's always weird when you see these profiles or someone goes to a Trump rally and like interviews people and is like, look, they're humans just like us. And it's like, of course they are human beings because everyone's a human being. And my goal would be to have a society where people can be human beings and the societal structures make life better for everyone, not a society that's not made up of human beings or that assumes that good people and bad people aren't just kind of people at the end of it.
So there's two things that intrigue me about the book. And they kind of link together, really, which is the magic. So one of them that I quite like is the idea that you've got magic in a world, but you can't magic away the world's problems. So like the environmental catastrophe is still happening. What's the magic like in the book?
So the magic has a very cool device where it's through a labyrinth. So you can recreate the labyrinth by drawing it, by pulsing out the patterns using a stress ball, by emoji spells on Tumblr, but you're recreating the pattern of this labyrinth, which is sort of the theme for the twisted ways that you try and see your way through. And it's very much mundane and frustrating. The analogy that I think is very obvious in the person who can see the future, Ian, is an analogy for anyone who's had anxiety, because he can see every possible future at the same time. So instead of being, liberating, it's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I can. I attended a. I'm actually training to be a church minister, and I attended something recently where they talked about all of the different leaders and how so many people suffer from imposter syndrome, of like voices in your head saying all the negative things that anyone could be thinking, and and I have basically quite an absent internal voice, so I was just looking around at everyone, and everyone was like nodding and going, "Oh yeah, this is so true," and I was like, wow, you guys must have a really distressing daily experience of life. And that's, it sounds like that Ian's got that times 10. Like,
knowing everything that could possibly go wrong, it really gets in the way of his love life.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I think that would just cause, yeah, that sounds, and I can see there where it's a really interesting narrative device, but it's also, you think magic, and it can be like do a spell and make things better, but actually here it's like adds loads of depth, but isn't necessarily adding like loads of utility. Like,
it means his goal is to make things a little bit better, to delay catastrophe as much as he can. And I had this conversation recently with somebody in my activist life about how it's too late for us to stop the climate apocalypse. That's baked in now. But what we can do is reduce suffering for people who are currently alive. And it doesn't sound good to write on the side of a bus, we can delay a little bit how much worse things are going to get, how fast. But it's actually really meaningful to actual human beings.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's also, the problem is it's less powerful as well. So the challenge with that is that the people who already aren't doing enough, when they see the you need to act to save the world, it's pretty good. You need to act to slightly, the world's wrecked, but you need to act to like make things 1% better, is seems significantly less like motivating, doesn't it? That is, but it's also, yeah, truth.
But I think that's where we need something like an anarchist vision of the future, because if we try and sell people, we can have this current version of happiness, this sort of like late capitalist version of success, but we have to reduce all of the things that are currently considered good in order to survive. That's kind of a miserable vision, and I see why on the imaging world, the fascists are winning that fight. You can have everything, or you can have much less of things. I know which one I pick. Versus the vision we have to sell people is The things you actually want that actually matter to you are unrelated to all of the things that you're currently being offered, which don't actually provide you with any kind of deeper meaning. And that's what we can offer you if you're willing to change the world. Because either way, the world's going to change. And I think that's very much where Cascade is going, to bring back to the book.
Yeah, and like Cascade is a world that's changed as well. So it's set sort of 10 years after there's been this big transformation in the world. It reminds me a bit, I'm in the middle of reading Last Smile in Sunder City by Luke Arnold, which is a book basically about where there's magical people, like magical creatures, like all the kind of classic ones like goblins and elves and things like that. And then humans are really sort of irritated about the fact that they don't have magic. And so they drill into the magic mountain thinking they can get magic. But what they do instead is they break magic. So all of the magical creatures in the world suddenly just, so like giants become these really weak things because they're too big. So without magic, they're just actually, they're like quite crippled by their inability to carry themselves, and loads of stuff like that. But how does Cascade deal with something that's happened in the past and is impacting people now?
I think the same way we are. There's a thing in the climate world of shifting baselines where I don't actually know what true winter's like. And if you have kids, your kids will think that winter does, for as a Canadian, winter doesn't mean snowdrifts taller than you are.
I mean, it's never meant that in England, but I get what you mean. I get what you mean.
I grew up with snowdrifts taller than I am. And yes, I've gotten taller, but I haven't gotten taller as fast as the snowdrifts have gotten shorter. And that's the shifting baselines, is that someone who's born now, that's normal to them. And even if we go back multiple generations very soon, it's going to be that nobody's ever experienced a normal winter. The phrase "the new normal" makes me want to punch someone, but that's where we're going. And so the same can be said whether your apocalypse is magical or climate. It's just the world now.
That is challenging. So we're going to move on to something now that is going to really test the limits of our journalistic integrity, as both yourself, Zilla, and myself. So we sell Cascade at beyondcataclysm.co.uk, and you should buy it. And you are friends with the author and have written stuff sort of around kind of the idea of Cascade a bit. However, the question we always ask is, what problems or challenges do you have with the book?
I mean, I literally wrote fix fiction for it.
I mean, there we go. So let's talk about fix fiction. That's exactly what you should talk about. There we go. Okay.
Yes. So for those of you who aren't immersed in the fan fiction world, there's lots of types of fan fiction, and fix fiction exists. For example, when you've got a character who has a rough life and you just want them to have a hug, and so you end up writing an entire novella just of an alternative universe without magic in it, so that by the end of the novella, that character can get a hug from someone.
I like this. I think there's a lot of books we can fix now. That's fine. I'm happy.
Yes. I think more characters need hugs in fiction. The world would be a better place. In reality, too. Like, reality, more people need hugs as well. But there's a lot of fictional characters that I would just like to reach through the pages and give hugs to. And most of them I can't, because most of them I have to scratch off the serial numbers if I want to write fiction about.
And it but. is It is difficult in fiction, isn't it? Because fiction gives you the real opportunity to write stuff that's harrowing and difficult. So my other sphere of writing, and what we sell a lot of with Beyond Cataclysm, and if you're interested in these things, we run a podcast called What is Roleplay? We do lots of stuff about roleplay games. And roleplay games, they're collaborative. And actually, kind of everyone at the table, you're inhabiting your characters. Playing a game that is really, really harrowing and miserable, it just doesn't really happen. Most games that you play end up having quite, you know, normal human interaction level humours going on and things like that. And even in different settings, you know, you're all meeting together to have fun. Books don't save you in that way. Books, your characters can be have very, very poor outcomes. So which bit did you, if there was one bit that you, that drove you to write something to fix, which bit was it in Cascade?
So it's not a single moment, but it is Ian Mallory's character, who's somebody who is relentless in doing what he thinks is the right thing. And that involves, because he can see the future, sometimes enlisting people who are his friends to do terrible things and to do unforgivable things in service of what might momentarily reduce 1% of human suffering.
Wow, so then it's even bigger. It's not just like the greater good in like a nice big, it's like actually I can pinpoint this down to it. Overall it is slightly better, but it's not, you know, when you hear greater good, it's told as like 100% good, but here it's like we're going to reduce 1% of suffering, right?
Yes, and he has limited amounts that he can keep other people's hands clean and his own hands clean. And he clearly has a lot of self-loathing that you may not understand without those voices in your head. But I promise you that there's other people who understand in the world. And I just feel like someone needs to give him a hug and tell him that even if what he's doing isn't right, he's seen for trying to do what's right.
Yeah, that's powerful. I think yeah, I may lack the voices, but it's taken me years, but I've realized very much that other people have the voices. So it's been a powerful journey for me, realizing that people have those voices. And it's also helped me understand why everyone thinks I'm a cocky scumbag, because I don't have the voices. So I just know I'm not the best podcast host in the world, but I'm all right. Like, as in, and that's it. I don't think I'm probably actually really bad. Never mind.
I just low-key assume that anyone I meet who's not a white man has the voices, but sometimes white men don't have the voices.
Interesting. What struck me at this thing I was at, which was, it's probably 50%. There's a lot of Afro-Caribbean faces.
Yeah.
But every white man, every white, everyone. I was the only person in the room.
I'd say everyone I've met except occasional white men. And so that means that I can just sort of like take it for granted that that's how the world is. Everyone I respect doesn't think they're good enough. And so I can just ignore it, right? Like, of course they're.
But it's so important to know, because if people that I respect, like you say, everyone that you respect doesn't think they're good enough. Everyone I respect, until a few years ago, I assumed, understood that I respect them because they're amazing.
But they don't respect themselves. So how can you respect them unless you are clearly misinformed and will find them out someday?
But like everything you have said today has been so eloquent and interesting, and you've got such a well-developed worldview, and you're so that, of course, you know that I think that about you, right?
Of course you think that about me. This is a cleverly constructed facade.
Oh, no. So then there's layers on layers. Fine. Okay. Going back to Cascade, rather than just the inevitable deconstruction of our psyche into just a kind of wobbling puddle on the floor.
I mean, we're authors. That's what we do.
Well, I'm an author and I just write things and I enjoy writing them. But apparently I'm the only one doing that. Why should people hunt out Cascade for a read?
Because it's brilliant. Because it's a perspective on the world we're forced to live in, but one that's funnier and more magical, and in some ways more hopeful than the one we have. Not in a sort of cozy hope, but in a very sort of aggressive get out there hope.
Aggressive hope. Love it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we need that, don't we? Because it's so easy to just, we talk about fantasy, but just to drop into fantasy or like role play games, you know, to play something that's better than our life, but to have something that reflects back and makes you think, no, if I grit my teeth, there is a hope to be had here. I like that. Any other recommendations for books if people get on with Cascade? Do we know when book 2 is coming out?
I mean, I have secret insider knowledge about book 2. I don't know the date it's out, but I can tell you that the draft is really good. So that's all I can say.
Sure. So, but it's not 10 years away. Not like the novel in my drawer that's probably got another 15 or 16 years to mature.
No, it's very much on the way, and I'm very excited for it.
Any but aside from Rachel's work, any other recommendations?
So I'm overwhelmed by choice, and so because you said one book rather than the entirety of my TBR list, I picked the book that's sitting on my desk right now as the one that I'm going to read next. I've cracked it, but I haven't actually read all the way through. So this is Another Dinner is Possible. It's a cookbook. And it is by Mike and Izzy. They have full names, but the full names aren't in the front of it. It is just a very delightful, kind vegan cookbook that I've read Izzy another book of hers, and it's very much got a lot about sort of the world that we want to make in a structure that happens to come around a lot for food, but food kind of underpins everything.
It does. It's unavoidable food.
It's the example when people try and tell me that you can make choices that aren't political, food is always the example that I bring back that no, you can't. Because everything about food is political.
I would accept that. I do definitely want to argue with you and try and think of a choice you can make that isn't political, but then I mean, the only one that came was breathing, but I mean, it is an involuntary, like at some point, it's not a choice breathing. And then are you breathing clean air or are you breathing horribly polluted stuff? And where are you breathing? And are you breathing quietly? And all of those things. And so, yeah, I think you probably win. I think you win that one there. So
I remember in high school, I had a teacher who taught us that the personal was political, and I remember us all arguing with her, and then by the end I sort of walked away, and it's one of the few high school lessons that have stayed with me this whole time of like, yeah, how I pack my lunch is a political choice, and at that point everything is, because yeah, any part of your existence is.
I've been a vegetarian for about 18 years, and I found it very interesting. I've recently moved more, you know, I'm much more inhabiting the role play game kind of space online and in the real world. But before that, I was also very in the punk world, and they're both quite progressive communities. But it's really interesting how the you know, things of identity and gender and things like that are very advanced in the role play game community. But no one's vegan. like as in the kind of the climate activism like stuff that you see a lot more in the punk scene, where like if you go to punk things and there was no and there's no meat available, that's not a surprise. So it does it intrigues me seeing the difference in even in like progression and how different how people are very advanced in some ways and maybe not so much in others.
I think my experience of people across the ocean is also that obviously there are Canadian vegans and British vegetarians, but I'm just far more single-use plastics among the British vegetarian vegan community and far more, but also far more vegans. So it's just little things where I think your social contact and also what the system allows for you to do.
I would love to get rid of plastic. I hate plastic. It seems.
But you also need to eat.
Yeah, it
and
seems.
You can't buy the food without it.
Yep. And a lot of vegan and vegetarian stuff is worse from that perspective. You know, is overly processed and overly packaged.
Versus in Canada, if there's not good vegetarian options, even you're probably not going to eat the vegan food because there's just nothing there other than, you know, would you like some plain rice?
Yeah, I've been to the Bring and Share meal where I've had rice with ketchup. Yep. Okay, marvelous. I apologize slightly to Rachel that we have maybe not concentrated on the book quite as much as we could, but I also think Rachel's intention with this book was to get us to concentrate on our own world as well. So I think we're okay there.
I mean, Rachel very much comes from an activist background, so I think she will forgive us.
My favorite memory of the chat with Rachel, and you should go back and look it up. I think it was episode 2. On this book I read, but my favorite episode was I think she had like 4 cats in the room, I think something like that, and I had 3 dogs in the room, so we had quite a large quantity of animals.
He has wonderful pets.
My pets aren't wonderful, they're quite irritating, but that is life. Brilliant. I think we have covered our ground there. So I have been Chris Lowry. As said before, you can find me on various social places as at CM Lowry Author. Zilla, where can we find more about you?
So the best place to find things about me, I'm part of an art cooperative collective group of friends called Nightbeats. So Nightbeats EU. For Nightbeats Extended Universe. So nightbeatseu.ca.
Indeed. Not Nightbeats European Union, which is what you think from from Britain when you look at that. You think,
No, it did not occur to me that you would think that.
So it's there's actually a domain name ending, like a TLD. Like, so yours is .ca, but .eu... is Europe. So when I look at your domain name, I always think, oh, Europe. Oh, .ca. What? This is confusing.
It's because all of our books will involve this common element of characters watching this TV show called Nightbeats, which was included, we came up with when a certain author was very publicly outing herself as a TERF. And we were like, oh shoot, we need to rewrite everything to involve references that don't involve everyone's favorite fandom. And we were like, if we pick a fictional fandom with no author,
they can never become problematic. I like that. That is a... Yes. It is. There's a whole other podcast discussing that, isn't there? Because I think we all had a, I th- I don't think we even need to say anyone listening will know who we're talking about. Like, but a magical person with a scar on their head is probably enough that we need to. But, you know, I had a really intense personal journey with writing and reading. Those books came out, the first book, when the lead of the book was in their first year at high school. I was in my first year at high school. And then the books came out once a year for the first 3 years. And so, yeah. And so what's hard, like you say, with choosing a fictional author, is when it's like, oh, that whole body of joy in my life, like, I'm sort of not allowed to have now. Like, as in, even like, there's no way of separating the one from the other, is there? You know?
I disagree with that take. I think that the joy it brought you belongs to you, and the version of the book that existed in your head belongs to you. And like, the author is dead. When you put a book out into the world, it belongs to the person who takes something from it. It doesn't belong to the author anymore. So I don't think that she gets to own all of the joy that I got out of it. That said, I'm not giving her any more of my money. And so I don't want to reference her in ways that might encourage other people to read it, because there's better stuff out there that can bring joy without giving her money.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I do still own my joy from those times and from my relationship with those books. But I had a conversation with someone at a convention or something, where I sort of reflected on this, you know, the sadness of something being lost. And they were like, they were so categorically like, I am attacked by the existence of those books, that it was made very clear to me that from their perspective, it hurt them for me to be taking. And like, on the one hand, we all need to not get as hurt by each other sometimes, maybe, as well. Yeah. But also, it was like,
we've lost a cultural touch point.
We have lost a cultural touch
point.
And
it's very hard if we don't have things that we can share our joy in, and we have to take solitary joy, because that is against the spirit of everything we do.
So, Zilla, I have never interviewed someone who, in the ending of the outro, we managed to still get derailed, and I'm like having to stop myself talking more, because we could just be talking more about this. This has been This Book I Read, a podcast from Beyond Cataclysm. If you enjoyed it, please check out our other episodes. Some of them we stay more on track. Coming soon is the Zilla and Chris 5-hour off track, like, economic, enviro, political, social podcast called What Is the World? You can also check out our other podcast, which actually exists rather than that one, What Is Roleplay, where we look at roleplay games and the idea of the concepts behind roleplay games without you needing to know anything about them at all. Please, if you've enjoyed this podcast, even if you've hated it, please give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts, because it does magical things to magical algorithms that are not magical and are probably deeply concerning, but we're still sort of a bit reliant on them. Our aim at Beyond Cataclysm is to try and sustainably pay Dave. Hello, Dave. Dave, insert a hello here. That would be nice. You're never in these podcasts. Dave won't have inserted that and will have just left me saying hello, Dave, without Dave actually saying anything. Dave is our in-house editor, artist, website maintainer, all of those sort of things. And you can support us by backing us at patreon.com/beyondcataclysm. Or by buying books such as Cascade at beyondcataclysm.co.uk. Do you have any final words for people, Zilla?
Don't trust anything I say.
Nice. Okay. And I'm not going to respond to that or say anything more. You have listened to This Book I Read, hosted by me, CM Lowry, and starring Zilla. Find out more about us, our podcasts, opportunities for submissions to our projects, and more at beyondcataclysm.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Bye.